Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for April 2025, where our panel of palliative care experts keeps you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our host, Dr. Jose Pereira, joins us for the 17th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch and is joined by his co-presenters, Drs. Sharon Watanabe and Ainaran Sinaraja. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University, McMaster University, McGill University, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. It is a part of the Palliative Care ECHO project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care ECHO project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Hello and welcome to this, and I believe it's the 17th episode of the Pallium Canada ECHO Palliative Care Journal Watch, which we just simply call the Palliative Care Journal Watch. My name is Jose Pereira, and today we'll be joined by my co-hosts, Dr. Sharon Watanabe and Dr. Ainaran Sinaraja. Welcome, folks, and supported by the team from Pallium Canada. For those of you who are joining us for the very first time, the Journal Watch is this collaborative that consists of folks from different universities across Canada, from divisions of palliative care, and we try and keep up to date with peer-reviewed palliative care literature. So what we do is we scan, and we've got several teams of about 15, 16 folks who regularly scan the literature. And when we identify an article that we think either changes our practice or confirms our practice or gives us food for thought, we bring it to the editorial team. And then the four of us, being Sharon, Ainaran, Leonie, myself, we then go through all the submissions. And then we, by consensus, select what we think are the top four articles. And we also identify four or five or six articles that we'd like to mention, which we refer to as the honorable mentions. So we'll come to that towards the end of this. The Palliative Care ECHO project, the palliative care project that supports the Journal Watch, is supported by a financial contribution from Health Canada. Pallium's ECHO project aims to cultivate communities of practice and provide additional palliative care-related continuous professional development opportunities for healthcare professionals across Canada to complement its LEAP courses. We do encourage you to visit our website. It's the echopalliative.com. There you'll find not only previous episodes of the Journal Watch, but in addition, in the ECHO Palliative website, you'll find webinars that we've provided over the last 2-3 years for you to download and to watch. Now, what to expect from today's session? We will present and discuss four articles that we've identified, and then we'll provide a list of honorable mentions at the end. We'll present for about 10 to 12 minutes each one of them. It's a Journal Watch, it's not a journal club, so we don't go into a very in-depth critical appraisal of the article, but we try to pull out what we think is the most important. We'll each discuss or present a paper and then open up to the panel for their thoughts on each one and then open up the floor for discussions. Introductions, as I said previously, I'm Jose Pereira and I'm a professor in the Faculty of Medicine and the Institute for Culture and Society at the University of Navarra in Spain. But I spent most of my years in practice in Canada, where I'm still a clinical professor in the Division of Palliative Care in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University. And I'm also scientific advisor and co-founder of Pallium Canada. And with that, I'll hand over to my colleagues to introduce themselves. Sharon, over to you.
Hello, I'm Sharon Watanabe. I'm a palliative care physician and director of palliative care at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, also a professor at the University of Alberta.
And over to you, Ainaran.
I'm Ainaran Sinaraja. I'm a research chair in Queen's University and Lake Ridge Health in Ontario. I'm also an associate professor at the Queen's University.
Thank you. And as we always have to do, we have to provide disclosures. Pallium Canada is a charitable organization that functions as a not-for-profit. Over the years, we've been funded by Health Canada and various other foundations, family foundations, that we do have some partnerships with provincial bodies and get some funding for that. But this particular program, the Journal Watch, is funded, as I said previously, by Health Canada in the form of a contribution program. As a scientific advisor, I do get honoraria from Pallium, and my colleagues don't have any conflicts to declare. So with that, I'm sure you're now eagerly awaiting to hear which are the articles we've chosen for today. Well, three quite large studies. So we're hoping to get through them in the relatively short time of about 40, 45 minutes we have. Two of them relate to dyspnea. And one of them, I would argue, has caused a lot of discussion and perhaps some consternation amongst the palliative care circles. So we thought we would bring it to you. And that's the one by Smallwood and colleagues. It's a systematic review and meta-analysis of opioids for the palliation of symptoms in people with serious respiratory illnesses. And then we're looking at palliative care in the emergency department and then cancer-related cognitive impairment. So with that, let's get to the first one. And so the first article we've chosen is one that's been written by Yamaguchi and a team in Japan. It's entitled Treatment Recommendations for Dyspnea in Patients with Advanced Disease, the Revised Clinical Guidelines from the Japanese Society for Palliative Medicine. And that was published in the Journal of Palliative Medicine in 2024. And the background to this highlights that dyspnea is a common symptom in patients with advanced diseases. And the authors describe prevalences of 50 to 70% in patients with advanced cancer and up to 90% in other advanced non-cancer diseases like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and heart failure, and it's associated with poor quality of life. The Japanese Society of Palliative Medicine published clinical guidelines for respiratory symptoms back in 2011 and then revised them in 2016. So the objective of this paper was to update the guidelines, especially given the growing importance of palliative care for non-cancer patients. In terms of the methods, they use several steps to go through the process of coming up with these recommendations. And I think it's worth going through them fairly quickly. So first of all, they started by establishing clinical questions. And they developed this by consensus with a small task force of six palliative care physicians, a nurse specialist, a pharmacist, and an epidemiologist. Interestingly, in the process, they also included patient family representatives, which I thought was very good. Then they looked at non-pharmacological treatments, which includes oxygen, high-flow nasal cannula for oxygen, and also fans. And they included that for all advanced diseases, so not just cancer, but also non-cancer. And then they looked also at pharmacological treatments, and those included opioids, benzodiazepines, and corticosteroids. But interestingly, they looked at only cancer for the pharmacological treatments. In our next article, we're going to look at the non-cancer population. So they conducted systematic reviews, and the paper outlines the process that they did, which is consistent with good practices related to systematic reviews. For the clinical questions related to pharmacological interventions, they prioritized randomized controlled trials, non-randomized controlled trials. And when those were not available, they looked at observational studies with control groups. And the selection strategies described in the article, I won't go through it now, but they went through a stepwise where they gave priority, as I said before, to the randomized control trials. And if those weren't there, they would look at non-randomized control trials or observational studies with control groups. They did not include case reports and case series. What they then did, they developed a set of draft recommendations, which were drafted by the task force group. And then they put this through a modified Delphi process, which included, I think, the members of the task group, plus representatives from eight stakeholder societies. So these were societies like the Japanese Respirology Society, the Japanese Palliative Care Society, and other stakeholder societies, including the Japanese Oncology Society, or the equivalent thereof. They reached consensus after three rounds. And then once they did that, they then still sent this for an external peer review process that included seven reviewers. And they used the MINDS grading system when they made the strength with respect to the quality of their recommendations, the strength of the recommendation, and the level of evidence as well. Now, just quickly to remind us what this is, in terms of strength of recommendations, a one is a strong recommendation, a two is a weak recommendation. So when we say a one, it's a strong recommendation to do the treatment or not to do the treatment. A two is a weak recommendation to do a treatment or not do the treatment. And then level of evidence, four levels, A is high, and that includes things such as the high quality randomized control trial down to D, which is very low. So with that background, let's look at their results. And I'm not going to go through all the results because it's pretty detailed, but just to give you a bit of a sample of what those look like. Their first question was, is supplemental oxygen useful for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease with hypoxemia at rest? And then the second one is supplemental oxygen useful for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease without hypoxemia at rest? And they then describe for each of these questions and each of the recommendations, the number of studies they found, the ones that were applicable, the ones that were not applicable, et cetera, as you would normally find in a systematic review. And the recommendations for oxygen therapy are listed here. So supplemental oxygen is suggested for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease without hypoxemia at rest. And that's a 2B recommendation. In other words, two is it's weak. In other words, the evidence to support that is either absent or suboptimal. And B means that the level of evidence is moderate. So two is a weak recommendation, and B refers to a moderate level of evidence. In terms of short burst oxygen, their recommendation is short burst oxygen is not suggested for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease without hypoxemia at rest. And then with respect to high flow nasal cannula oxygen therapy, their recommendation is that it is suggested for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease with hypoxemia that is refractory to standard oxygen therapy. And that's a 2C recommendation. In other words, it's relatively weak and the level of evidence is also relatively weak, but it's there. Jumping to opioids, I'm skipping out all the other non-pharmacological treatments like FANS and also some of the other medications such as corticosteroids and benzodiazepines and going to opioids. And the question there is systematic morphine useful for treating dyspnea in patients with advanced cancer? And there they identified 7 randomized controlled trials. And based on that, plus several other trials that they also included and other publications, they came out with a 1B level recommendation, which is systemic morphine is recommended for dyspnea in patients with advanced cancer. And they go on to look at the evidence for oxycodone, which they say is present for hydromorphone for fentanyl. And as I said, please do read the article to look at all the other recommendations regarding the other pharmacological and non-pharmacological interventions. So the key discussion points, and in their own words, hence the inverted commas, the parentheses that I put this in, they wrote, these guidelines are derived from a combination of the best available evidence and expert consensus. It is crucial to acknowledge that the evidence levels for most recommendations remain low, primarily owing to the challenges of conducting high-quality clinical research in vulnerable advanced disease patients. Then they go on to speak about, we need to take into consideration other factors when making decisions about which treatment to initiate in a particular patient. And for that, we need to take into consideration pharmacoeconomic factors, as well as patients' preferences. And what I really like about the paper is there's a useful flow diagram to help decision-making. So I thought in terms of the strengths, extensive and large process, must have been an enormous amount of work to do this across all these different pharmacological and non-pharmacological interventions. So in terms of the limitations, I thought it's a pity that they didn't include the non-cancer patients. And I think that this is a useful article in terms of informing clinical practice. So what do my colleagues think?
Yes, thanks, Jose, for bringing this forward. It is an extensive process that this group undertook. And I think that's a characteristic of the guidelines issued by this particular organization. I guess one thing I noticed is that they only looked up until 2019.
Correct, I should mention that.
So yeah. I wondered if there was anything that had come out of since then of relevance. And their criteria for including papers was pretty broad beyond randomized controlled trials. But I think ultimately, most of the clinical questions had been subject to multiple randomized controlled trials. I guess it's a Delphi process. So by nature, it does involve clinical expertise and consensus. And so there is some interpretation and clinical judgment involved. So if you gave these findings to a different group, the conclusions could possibly be different. But I agree, it's a very useful paper.
There is a question as well in the chat that I wanted to highlight, Jose. The question is around how was the hypoxemia defined? And for the dyspnea, was there any mention of CPAP or BiPAP?
Ah, very good. So the second part of it, I didn't see any mention of CPAP or BiPAP. So that's obviously something that's missing. They focused only on high flow nasal cannula in terms of the oxygen delivery. Hypoxemia, it was defined as reported by the studies. So I would presume that the studies would have included some sort of definition, but there was no standardized method or definition across the studies that the authors looked for. I see there's a question here from Raul. Regular opioids and dyspnea advanced cancer. Is there a ceiling dose for morphine in the setting? The suggested increased dose in those already on morphine and expecting a response seems counterintuitive. I mean, in my practice and what we've learned over the years has been that, yes, one can titrate the dose up as well. So there is a dose effect. I'm not aware of any study that says there is a maximum dose, but obviously the maximum dose is dictated to by the clinical response or the appearance of any intolerable side effects. But I don't know what, Sharon Eingren, what do you think of that? Good question.
Yes, agree, your response.
And again, you know, if there is a respiratory illness, then one would titrate slower, more gradually and slower. So the second one looks at non-cancer patients. So this was a study that was published by Smallwood and colleagues. And this is a team of folks from various countries, including Australia, the Netherlands, the UK, as well as Sweden. It was published in the European Respiratory Review, the journal, in 2024. It's entitled Opioids for the Palliation of Symptoms in People with Serious Respiratory Illness, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And in the background, the authors highlight again that people living with serious respiratory illnesses experience a high burden of symptoms, including dyspnea. And they define what they mean by serious illness. And they define it as a condition that carries a high risk of mortality, negatively impacts quality of life and daily function, and is burdensome in terms of symptoms, treatments, or caregiver stress. And breathlessness, they define as a subjective experience of breathing discomfort and highlight that it can vary in intensity and quality. They then speak about opioids being recommended when breathlessness is chronic and distressing despite optimizing disease-modifying treatments. But they say in their background section that the benefits are unclear and that there are side effects to the opioids. Now, this team, when I looked at it, they are primarily, it appears, to be respirologists. And they also did this study on behalf of the European Respiratory Society. So the study objective was to study the effectiveness. In one place, they speak of the efficacy, and another one, the effectiveness. And we know there's a difference between those two. And safety of opioids for symptom management in people with serious respiratory illness. So let's jump into the methods. So as I said previously, they did a systematic review and meta-analysis. They described the databases they looked at, which included Embase, Medline, and the Cochrane, a register of controlled trials. They searched up until July 2022. And the inclusion criteria included chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases, interstitial lung diseases, and all other diseases, not cancer. And they included only randomized crossover trials, so randomized control trials or randomized cluster trials of opioids to treat symptoms in people with these advanced respiratory illnesses. As part of the exclusion criteria, they said they would exclude any study that had fewer than 80% of participants having a non-malignant lung disease. And their primary outcome was breathlessness, and then secondary outcomes included quality of life, cough, arterial blood parameters, and for these, they left it up to the studies to define the validated instruments. So obviously, because they're different studies, often different instruments are used, as long as they were reported to be validated and appropriate. They also assessed the risk of biases using the Cochrane risk of bias tool. And in terms of the statistics, they used the standardized mean difference, and they described that in the paper. And they also looked at effect sizes using, I believe, the Cohen's D effect size. So overall, I think a well-conducted systematic review and the meta-analysis. The results, 17 studies were included. Now, what is interesting in this study was they divided the studies up into those that occurred in a laboratory setting and those that were in a home setting. So there were 6 studies that were laboratory-based, and these were studies where exercise was involved to precipitate the dyspnea. And then the 10 home studies looked at breathlessness in daily life. The laboratory studies included 70 patients in total, and the home care one included 788 participants in total. And one of the 18 studies was conducted in both settings. Now, for the home studies, the patients had to be on an opioid for 4 or more days consecutively. And in the laboratory studies, which I said were all small with numbers of 20 or fewer participants, but in those studies, 5 of those studies were single dose studies or limited dose studies. And in the cancer world, we've tried to exclude those studies because they don't seem to be helpful in determining the longer term impact on chronic dyspnea. But we'll come to the results shortly. All of the studies compared the opioid to placebo, one of them compared to promethazine, I think it was. And overall certainty of evidence was very low to low, according to the authors. They write here, 5 had a high risk of bias in one domain, and an additional 10 had an unclear risk of bias in up to 3 domains. 12 studies they felt were deemed unclear risk due to a lack of prospectively registered outcome reporting plans. And these were studies that were done, I think, relatively earlier, so a few years ago. I'm not so sure if, I guess in today's world, we would look at that as being a risk, understandably, but I think in previous years, that wasn't always valued as or understood to be a risk. Now, opioids reduced breathlessness. Now, this is important. This is their main results. Opioids reduced breathlessness during laboratory exercise testing, and it reduced in their calculations by about 10 millimeters in a 10 centimeter scale, which they deemed that to be statistically and clinically significant. But opioids did not reduce breathlessness measured in the daily life studies. They found no effects, so no benefits on quality of life parameters or on cough. And when they looked at side effects in the at-home studies, opioids, they said, led to increased frequency of nausea, vomiting, constipation, and drowsiness. And in the article, they make a statement there that some serious adverse events were identified, hospitalization and death. That was in one of the studies, a randomized control study that was published in 2020. I think it was in JAMA. It is called the BEAM study. And as a result of that BEAM study, actually, I was reading up that the European Respiratory Society recommended avoiding the use of opioids for chronic dyspnea in patients with advanced respiratory diseases. So let's go now to the key discussion point. So the authors write, and again, I'll quote them, this systematic review and meta-analysis identified that opioids, when compared to placebo, had no statistically or clinically significant effect on breathlessness. Outcomes when compared to placebo had no statistically or clinically significant effect on breathlessness. Outcomes measured pragmatically in daily life at home in people with non-malignant serious respiratory illnesses. But they did find impact in the laboratory. So those studies that were done in the laboratory and measured, they did find that it did reduce the dyspnea. They go on to say the treatment emergent adverse events reported in the included studies were often mild and self-limiting on withdrawal of opioids, though it should be noted that even low-grade adverse events can be detrimental to quality of life. I thought there was a little bit of a tone there. It's perhaps somewhat a bit negative towards the opioid.
So I think we were at under discussion that the mechanism of action of opioids to reduce breathlessness are poorly understood. At present, traditionally, it's been thought to reduce the perception of breathlessness, but there may be more to it. So strengths, looking at 2 different settings and limiting the review to randomized controlled trials and limitations, homogeneity of the participants, so the vast majority had chronic obstructive lung disease. So practice impact, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And so there are limitations in the available evidence. So it does not rule out the possibility that there could be a beneficial effect of opioids administered to patients who are in the home setting. So the authors state there are limited data on the use of opioids to treat breathlessness in people with non-malignant serious respiratory illness who are at the very end of life. Given that many physicians consider prescribing opioids only at the end of life palliative care setting, it's important to not rule out a potential beneficial treatment effect in this circumstance. So some patients may still benefit where benefits outweigh burdens. Be selective and prudent when considering opioids in these cases. So Angeran, your thoughts?
to read about this, and Jose's comment about this creating controversy in the European circles would be interesting to hear more about. I admit, in Canada, I don't think we have heard as much about this yet. But certainly, we do tend to be cautious in non-malignant and opioids. We only come to it as a last resort, don't we, as a normal part of practice, because we recognize the evidence is not as present as in cancer. But they do have some very strong conclusions, don't they? And so I can see why. And it highlighted that one RCT, which I don't recall reading before, the BEAMS trial out of Australia, that did show some higher adverse events in the intervention arm. So that's interesting to read about, for sure. What did you think, Sharon?
Yeah, similar thoughts. And ultimately, I guess what came to mind is that opioids can be used, but patients need to be informed about the uncertainty around the benefit and also the possibility of adverse events. And of course, there needs to be very careful follow-up. Welcome back, Jose.
Thank you. The gremlins are at play here. We had a power failure here. And in the internet, we're down as well. Everything went down. So I apologize to the participants. And thanks for keeping things going. Yeah. I was going to add that in. I still think that there is a role for opioids in very, very advanced disease after optimizing all the treatments. But I think we need to be a bit more careful, more judicious in our use of it. And I look forward to studies in the future that can identify which are the patients who would benefit from it versus those who don't.
Jose, there are two questions in the chat, in the question and answer. I wonder whether you have time to address those.
Sure.
The first one asked about whether there were any other mention of any other medications like benzos.
So they didn't study the other medications. So unlike the study by Yamaguchi that we presented first, they did not look at other medications. They looked at only opioids. But I think in the discussion, they say, look, you know, there are other measures that can be taken, but they've specifically focused on the opioids only.
In terms of the exercise components, do they comment on whether there were equivalent exercises being conducted across the studies?
Actually, that's a good comment or question. So the researchers, when they identified the studies, they specifically looked at what type of exercise was there. And if it was standardized, then they would include the study. They actually excluded one study because it spoke about the 6-minute walk test without any other descriptions. So they specifically looked at that as one of the inclusion criteria. And they included only those where they thought it was standardized and appropriate and validated method.
And then the last question was whether there were any other symptoms other than breathlessness reviewed.
Yes, there was. So cough was the other one. And as well for cough, they found no improvement in cough. But I think based on the fact that they were looking at exercise, now, at least in the group with exercise, I suspect that these are patients who are still quite ambulatory and earlier on. For the home-based ones, that might be very different.
And maybe this is the last question in the interest of time. Was there any use of buprenorphine in these studies?
No, I did not see buprenorphine. I saw morphine. I saw codeine, dihydrocodeine. And morphine was actually in short-acting and also sustained-release morphine, oxycodone, Capinol, diamorphine I mentioned already. Yeah, did not see buprenorphine. Over to you.
Thanks, my turn. This study is palliative care initiated in the emergency department, a cluster randomized clinical trial from the Grudson group, published in JAMA in February of 2025 this year. And so we all know that emergency department offers an opportunity to initiate palliative care for older adults. That is high emergency department visits in the US, but also in Canada, I know. And there was a prior study published by this group that showed that palliative care consultation for patients with advanced cancer improved quality of life at 12 weeks. And so they now wanted to turn their attention to primary palliative care delivered by emergency clinicians and see what that might look like. The primary outcome was the hospital admission that may or may not have happened from that emergency visit. And they also looked at subsequent healthcare use and survival in 6 months. They used a cluster randomized stepped wedge design across 29 emergency departments across the US. And they involved various clinicians, so the physicians, the nurse practitioners, the physician assistants, and the nurses. The intervention, and this is important to sort of think about what the intervention was. So the intervention involved a 1-hour education session at the beginning. So that was pre-start of the intervention. There was a simulation, 4-hour simulation training on serious illness conversation done with the team. There was clinical decision support built into the EMRs. And there were actually various EMRs across the organization. So not just one type. So it included Epic, it had Cerner, I believe, And then finally, there was audit and feedback for the eMERGE clinical staff. This occurred over 5 years, and you can see that it spanned the COVID time periods as well. And in terms of the patients who were eligible to be offered this intervention, they were more than 66 years old. They had a high comorbidity score, which represents a mortality risk of greater than 30%. They did exclude patients who were living in nursing homes or were already seen by the American version of palliative home care, which is hospice there. So there were almost 100,000 ED visits over this period. And the main outcome was that there was no difference in hospital admission rates between the pre-intervention and the post-intervention periods. They accounted for the temporal trends, they accounted for the COVID pandemic, and admission rates were still around 62 to 65%. There was no differences in any of the secondary outcomes like ICU admission, eMERGE revisits, hospice use, home health use, hospital readmissions, and there was no difference in death at 6 months, which is about 30%. The other interesting thing was that when they did die, the average length of survival was only 17 days, actually. So in terms of the strength, I mean, they certainly had a lots of sites that were participating. It looked like it spanned organizations. I would be curious to see how they got all of them to agree to do this, but that was very impressive for me to see. They did not present the results of the pre-intervention palliative care skills and knowledge assessment, which is part of a proper implementation project. And usually that then leads to the type of intervention to do, but they did not actually present on that part. Certainly the stepped wedge design might have some impacts from external factors that could influence primary outcomes, like COVID, which had a huge impact on emergency care. And remember, at that early periods, the many home agencies might have refused to accept patients with COVID. We're not clear on, you know, how that affected the patient population who presented. There were staffing shortages in eMERGE. Just a reminder as well that the communication skills training did not extend to any of the trainees who were in eMERGE. And then there was also high turnover, especially nurses during this time period. And so they did not get any of the palliative care training. Really, there was no impact found. It looks like this intervention focused on education, including simulation workshop, clinical decision support, audit and feedback did not make a difference in this case. One could ask, is hospital admission an acceptable outcome? What if we had stratified by mortality risk? Might we have seen some difference if it is for those patients who are earlier on? So because some of these patients were quite short near the end of life, how does this look like with integration with community resources? If you look at the various ED sites and the various hospital sites, some of them did have lower hospital admissions rates after the intervention. And so is it a random effect? Is it a site-specific facilitator? And the editorial that accompanied it made a good point. Large-scale interventions designed to enhance care should not presume that education is the primary deficit, especially if there are other new or additional resources that may be required. So we'll need to keep that in mind. So we're still waiting for high-quality primary palliative care evidence, I would argue. We still need to, as a specialist force, continue to support emergency departments in delivery of palliative care. Thank you.
Very good. When I read this, I thought, my goodness, what a massive effort this was. It was an incredible effort by this research team to do the study that they did. And I can imagine the disappointment when the pandemic came across, because I think that that was a real big curveball with this study. Things changed so much. The whole nature of the emergency rooms changed so much that it's a big limitation of the study. And the other one I thought as well was, they say it's an education intervention, but the education was 1 hour didactic, basically, presentation. And I would argue that a 1 hour didactic presentation, you cannot acquire primary palliative care skill sets with a 1 hour intervention. And I think their follow-up approach was embedded within their health records that there was a flag to say this is a patient who may have palliative care needs. So enormous amount of study work. It would be good to repeat it if possible outside of a pandemic scenario. And I would like to see a more robust education intervention.
Yeah, a couple of comments I would make. The educational part, again, the editorial reminds us that it's not always an educational deficit. There are other reasons for change, such as competing priorities, busy settings. And so sometimes the intervention might actually need to target other things. And certainly it reminds me, Sharon and I have been doing the early part of care project in Alberta. And in that, for oncologists, we did not do education. We focused on these other deficits that they told us were the biggest problem around workflows, making it easier to do high quality palliative care. And so we did not actually do an education for them. And it actually did seem to make a difference in that case. There is a question in the chat about the mortality rate and whether there is room for early identification for sure. That's one thing we saw here, and whether the outcomes would have been different if the identification had happened earlier. Certainly, there's great evidence for early identification and palliative care approach. And then the second question is around the levels of palliative care provision in the emergency as defined within the study. Could education and training be considered part of tertiary care provision? I am not sure we would define a one-hour didactic and four-hour serious illness as tertiary care. I don't know what the group thinks.
Yeah, I don't think so either. You know, I'm reminded about it during the pandemic. I remember getting calls from emergency rooms because we're talking about the education. And I mean, obviously, as a proponent of education or most of my career, you know, I think there's a role and it's important. It's not just education. There are other approaches done as well. But if you do other approaches without education and the opportunity presents itself where you need to apply skills and you don't have them, I think it's a problem. And during the pandemic, I remember getting a lot of calls from emergency rooms of colleagues who had in the emergency rooms that had no training and feeling very, very distressed by having to care for these patients. So, you know, I think education alone does not always work, but I think in most cases, you do need to include education. You mentioned oncology. I would argue that I think across Canada, palliative care has been to a certain degree integrated more into oncology than other areas. And so there might be already this sensitization to palliative care and some basic skills around it. And most oncology residents in Canada do palliative care training. I wonder about the other specialty areas such as emergency, neurology, cardiology, et cetera. I don't think it's the same thing.
Sharon, any final thoughts before we move on?
Nothing to add. All right, here we are. So this should be brief. The title of this article is Cancer-Related Cognitive Impairment, a Practical Guide for Oncologists. And it was recently published in JCO Oncology Practice. The first author is Yu Zhang, and the authors come from Connecticut and Texas. And so this is a practice review article and focusing on the phenomenon of cancer-related cognitive impairment. And this is a subacute, chronic, and sometimes progressive syndrome that is caused either by the cancer itself or treatment of the cancer. And that could include surgery, radiotherapy, and any type of systemic therapy. It's fairly common. And so studies suggest that approximately 30% of patients with cancer will have some cognitive impairment prior to treatment and then go up to 75% during treatment. And then after treatment, the cognitive impairment can persist in 35%. This significantly impacts patient well-being, so quality of life, relationships, and ability to work. And it is often not recognized. And its existence is somewhat controversial, because as we'll see that it can be difficult to diagnose, but there are studies in the basic science and neuroimaging realm that demonstrate that people with cancer, including those on treatment, will have changes in the neuronal cells, glial cells, and also brain function and structure. So the objective of this publication was to raise awareness of this syndrome and provide recommendations on screening and management. So the first challenge is in diagnosing this, because when you apply the usual cognitive tests, they can come out normal or just slightly impaired. And in fact, we see this in our own clinic because we do routine cognitive screening. And even though patients may tell us that they're having problems with their memory or attention, executive functioning, this might not show up on the cognitive tests. So we have to rely more on what patients tell us they're experiencing. And also comorbidities can also affect cognition. So that would include aging, as cancer disproportionately affects the elderly. And also if they're having pain and are medications that affect the central nervous system, that can also affect cognition. So one of the points is that anything that might be reversible, such as reviewing medications should be considered. The other point that these authors strongly make is to not dismiss when patients say they're having problems with aspects of their cognition, because the risk is that if these symptoms are dismissed or diminished, then patients can question their reality and it can disrupt the therapeutic relationship, et cetera. And so there is a new body of literature on the phenomenon of medical gaslighting. And so that's something that we need to avoid. And the other challenge is that there is a lack of standardized and evidence-based interventions. So the recommendations are to routinely screen, not using a tool, but a question such as, have you had any changes in your thinking, memory, or attention? And have these changes affected your daily life? And in the article, it gives a list of common symptoms that people experiencing this type of cognitive impairment might report. And then in terms of interventions, there's limited evidence. These authors feel that the best evidence is for physical exercise. And for people who cannot undertake physical exercise, the alternatives are yoga, alternatively, mindful meditation or relaxation exercises. In fact, when looking at the studies that they quoted, the only RCT that was included showed a positive effect for yoga more so than for a physical exercise program. In any case, if there's something physical that can be done, that may be helpful. And then compensatory strategies such as note-taking. And in some select situations, you might refer to neuropsychiatry, but it's recognized that this is not necessarily a resource that is universally available, so probably is not going to be helpful for the majority. So I thought that this was a practical paper raising awareness about a common syndrome and providing some suggestions for interventions that have some evidence for helpfulness. So I'll leave it at that. And I see there's one question, cognitive frailty or cognitive impairment was screened for prior to the initiation. Yes, so I guess in the studies that are quoted, there is a cohort of people who have pre-existing cognitive impairment, and it is recognized that people who have that have a higher risk of worsening of a cognition during treatment. Would you consider cognitive impairment, cognitive failure, and delirium to be symptoms which reflect different levels of alterations of sensorium in advanced cancer? Is there a standard reference for defining them? Yes, I guess for delirium, there are the DSM criteria that can be evaluated using validated tools like the CAMP, for example. Cognitive impairment, yes, some tools, like in our clinic, we use the MINICOG together with CAM. And so in MINICOG, they will give you some cutoffs for what constitutes cognitive impairment. So I think there are some definitions. And so they're, as you point out, they're not synonymous, cognitive impairment. You can have cognitive impairment without necessarily having delirium. Do clinical trials account for or include the impact of chemo treatments on cognition? That is a good question. I think I would have to check to be sure, but I believe it's on the list of adverse effects that are monitored in the course of clinical trials, but I would have to verify that. I'd be surprised if it was not. Thank you for those questions.
Yeah, I too found this very interesting and very practical. I was quite intrigued, Sharon, when in the discussion, I think it was, they were speaking about why there is a reduced awareness of this in oncology, and obviously would also, I think, relate to primary care, palliative care. And they mentioned the fact that because these cognitive tests are often negative, that they will say it's not a physical thing happening. But in the discussion, the authors do provide evidence why there's actual physical changes happening at a cellular level that might not be picked up through these clinical tests with cognitive tests. But when they do more intensive neuroimaging, actually see the changes happening.
Yes, correct.
I think part of the response we provide to patients undergoing various symptoms, including this, but also like fatigue, is this sitting this in this discomfort of this. Unfortunately, nothing we can do to fix it, but it's still important to validate and listen, right? And that's a big part of the advice, which I really value. So that's great that we need to be mindful about this phenomena, chemo fog, chemo brain, that we sometimes hear about, isn't it? So thanks. Yeah, it's a great highlighting article.
Good. So with that, then on to the honorable mentions, and we'll take turns today. I'll start off and then Sharon and then Aingaran. So the first one is a study by two Portuguese colleagues, Feliciano and Reis Pena, enhancing end-of-life care with home-based palliative care interventions. And that's a systematic review. And I found it very interesting in that it summarizes very nicely different components that make up what we refer to as home-based palliative care.
The next article is by Brown et al. Multiple points of system failure underpin continuous subcutaneous infusion safety incidents in palliative care, a mixed methods analysis published in Palliative Medicine. So for those settings that do use continuous subcu infusions, it points out what may be some pain points where the system may fail.
What I also like about that paper is it highlights quality improvement and the
Yes.
importance of quality improvement in different specialty areas and primary care as well, which is specialty.
The third paper by Austin looks at the efficacy of spiritual interventions in palliative care, an umbrella review of systematic reviews. That's quite the mouthful there. Palliative Medicine published earlier this year. We all know the importance of spiritual care, especially in palliative care, and this reviews that, the studies of those.
And the next one is by Sachs and colleagues, and that it is published in JAMA 2025, January, and it's Palliative Care Program for Community Dwelling Individuals with Dementia and Caregivers, the in-piece randomized clinical trial, which covers a very important area. And we're seeing more and more people living with dementia and the burden that we see it as well on caregivers.
And the next paper is by Lau et al. Research priorities in neural palliative care, a consensus statement from the International Neural Palliative Care Society. And this was submitted by Dr. Janice Miyazaki, who is an expert in the area. So she says that this consensus statement demonstrates the flourishing of neural palliative care as a subspecialty and the growing realization that neurologists must incorporate palliative care skills and lens to research.
And last but not least, John's published on how racialized approaches to opioid use disorder and opioid misuse management can hamper pharmacoequity for cancer pain in JCO in 2025, earlier this year as well. Again, highlighting again how we do have to be mindful of equity deserving populations and how we manage pain. I remember a Journal Watch a year or two ago, we did review a similar paper that did show these inequities continue to exist in pain management.
And that's it for today. A little bit over the hour, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry for the disruptions as well caused by power failures and internet failures. And again, thank you to all the team members in all these different divisions for monitoring the papers, for submitting their thoughts, their most interesting papers. A big thank you to the Pallium support team. And I want to say, we don't often say this, but a very, very big thank you to all the researchers and writers of all these different articles. A lot of work and effort goes into them, and to all the participants who have given us the opportunity to do the studies and learn more. Thank you all for joining us, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other Palliative Care Echo Project activities, please feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012. Licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Elias Chirfan. See you soon.